Ja.
Där ute. Vi kan säga till dem att det finns. Vi kan.
Men du får dela.
Hon är i det rummet.
Ja, men jag sköter det där ute, men det är viktigt att du går och assisterar den här, för då hör hon på kontroll och sådär, så får hon gissa lite
så. Kan du säga så att Amelia ville att vi skulle få dem där?
Det ska jag.
Mm. Ja, jag kan också komma ut och hjälpa dig. Hallå, hallå, Sjön. Nej, men du kan gissa. Meliana, är det du? Ja, du kan gissa hur jag ser.
just could have been just like some of the other things that he created. But he blew the breath of life in man, and man became a living soul. And he charged man that thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart, all of thy might, and all of thy strength, and thy neighbor as thyself. And your neighbor is everybody. And each person who is born for a specific purpose. To find that purpose in life, we will be able to contribute that that God has brought us here for. And the main thing is to love. Love your neighbor who is your neighbor. Everybody on the face of the earth is your neighbor. There is no petition as I am from America, somebody else is from some other sect. But we can tell now when we think of wars and how different countries contribute to wars of one person who started. We can realize that when we think of medicines of all description that science has come up with that will cure certain diseases. And it does not only help the citizens of that specific country, but to everybody. So it actually shows that our neighbors have grown so close together now, different countries, different eyes, different people of whatever denomination that you might be. And when you do, you are doing according to what we are here for, to love your neighbor. But it also says to love yourself first. And when I see the things that are going on in the United States of America, when I talk to some of these young people, it frightens me. Because they have no idea of why they are here on earth. Like a 14-year-old child saying, I'm not going to live until I'm 19 years old. Well, somebody needs to talk to young people like that. Because you are here for a purpose. You're here to grow and to contribute. And even though the pathway may be hard, you will get your reward. And at the end. And I think of myself, of how I came up in a family in Savannah, Georgia, where we knew nothing about color, and yet we knew that we lived in a community that people of color were there. But in the home, we were taught that you are as good as you behave yourself. You are as good as you contribute to the world the very best that is in you. And my mother happened to be an activist, a civil rights activist. And through the years, until 1920, no woman of any race could register and vote in the United States of America. And as soon as there was a law passed that women could vote, my mother with her horse Bhagavati. Had me to be in the buggy with her, and we would go, I would get out of the buggy, knock on the door, ring the doorbell, and help to bring these people out of their homes, and she would take them to the pool, first to the registration office, and next to the pool. And that was the service. I think that planted a seed within me. Later on, I started working for the United States Department of Agriculture. And it was the saddest thing to see the system that anybody dared to try to disturb, the system of the Ku Klux Klan, who did not want their way of life changed. And why? Because when 1865, emancipation was declared, the Africans were set free. And they did not say, I have my freedom. They might have been shackled physically, but mentally, even though they were in the on plantation, they still believed that there would be freedom for them. And that during that time, the Negro spirituals were born. They could not read, they could not write, but they looked forward to a day when they were free. And they would learn, among themselves, they would start certain songs, like some of these mornings, bright and clear. I'm going to stretch my wings and cleave the air. And the plantation owner thought that they were talking about when they died. But they were talking about the way they would get, how they were going to do when they got off the farm. When emancipation was declared, those people who were slaves gave to their children nearly 16 million acres of land. They gave them the funeral homes. They gave them the insurance companies. They gave them the churches, the schools, the colleges, the universities. Yet they were not allowed to read, not to write, while they were slaves. And they didn't only do that. The men, of course, were the ones who could run for office. And those Africans became senators, congressmen, city officials like the police, the sheriff's department, mayor, and in all of the other political positions they had. Then the racists decided that we don't want this to happen. We don't want those people to have anything to do with our way of life. And in Washington, they put up so many herds. Among them were the gag rule, which meant that nothing with reference to African Americans was come up on a bill presented to Congress. And in 1910, they closed the door for African Americans to become registered voters. All they had to pay their taxes and everything else. The men in the rural district had to to work the room for 3 days to pay for poll tax. Poll tax is something that they had to pay to be able to vote. But they could not vote. A few of them passed, but only because maybe the plantation owner was going to, or somebody who was running for an office needed votes. And this is the way it went. When I became 21 years of age, I went to be registered. I had no trouble whatsoever because I was working for the federal government. So they feared not to, to give me the permission to become a registered voter. However, it did not make me feel good to think that they had special. And here my people, since 1910, are not able to register and vote. So my husband, who was a county agent, said, we are doing 2 things wrong. We are not waking these people up, opening their eyes, to let them know that they don't have to put up with a sheriff who would beat people, a sheriff who would kill them. And when they reported it, it was justifiable homicide. We're not helping our people when they're making cotton, and that was the cotton section in the South, and other crops too throughout the South. We're not helping them when they don't get any pay for what they're doing. And at the end of the year, they are told, you are almost out of debt. Do better next time. These things made us realize that if we are our brother's keeper, we are going to have to fight to help them to become first-class citizens. So we began to work with them, encourage them to get off of those plantations. We got quite a few of them who did. We told them that cotton has been king. But cotton, the price of cotton is to fall, and it's not going to be long. And this plantation will not need you. So we're going to try to find, with your help and your friends, some land. Now, everybody in that section was not a racist. But unfortunately, those who were not racist were actually afraid to stand up and speak against the wrong that the racists were doing to people of color. I'm sure we've got some of that today, where people fear to stand up and speak against something that's wrong. But we did not become popular. We became a type of person that the racists who ran the South, very disturbing their way of life. Because their way of life was the same as it was before emancipation, before freedom. And they did not want to turn that way loose. We had to go above what they liked. We had to fight and fight for the odds of what they did to us. We continued to get these people off of the farm. We continued left out the teaching how to do the applications of which were only one and one half page. But as we fought through the years to get these people registered, George Wallace, who was the governor of the state of Alabama, said, we are not going to have it. We are going to do something that we know was done. So the applications went from one and a half pages to 10 pages long. 10 questions on each page. And the registrar could not even read them. But they expected those who were making an attempt to register to know the questions. The questions would come down to the cities and the towns on Monday night, the second, and the fourth Monday night. And registration was the second and fourth Tuesdays. The office was open at approximately 9 or 10 o'clock, closed at 12 o'clock for dinner, for lunch, opened again at 1 or 2, and closed at 4. And there all of these people trying to register could not register because it would be that offices closed or for some specific reason. In 1955, Rosa Parks, a very intelligent, unassuming, sweet lady, sat on the bus. She sat in the section that was for color. And the bus was filled. Then the driver of the bus noticed there was one white man who was standing. And he came back and told Rosa Parks, get up and give this white gentleman a seat. And Rosa just sat there. She wouldn't even move. And after he found out he could not get her up, he went out and got the police. The police came in and drug her out, threw her in jail, because she would not give the seat up to this white gentleman. She stayed there a half hour thinking what to do. Then she called a man by the name of E.D. Nixon. And E.D. Nixon was the man that most African Americans would bring their troubles to. And he would perhaps contact the NAACP, which is an organization of color, or poor, which was an or take it to whatever department it was that seemingly had been causing this woman or this specific person to be ostracized. Then he said, I'll be there to get you. He went to the jail, got her out, called all ministers throughout the city and town of Montgomery. And this is in Montgomery, Alabama. They went. And he told the one and said, we are going to have to organize. So they organized. And then finally somebody said, well now, we're going to have a president. Mr. Nixon has worked with us. I nominate Mr. Nixon. And Mr. Nixon said, "Gentlemen, we have a young man who has been with us a little more than a year. And I will not become president of anything as long as you have young people. Consequently, I decline in favor of this young man who is the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, Reverend Martin Luther King." And everybody stood up. And Dr. King became president. Well, here we were, working so hard to get people registered. And the fear that people had was something that was so big that you didn't know whom you were talking to. The whites who were not racist were afraid to open their mouths against the racists who ran the state, not only the state of Alabama, but Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, a part of Texas, Tennessee, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, and North Carolina. All of those were in the same group. And whenever they had a governor at a meeting, they all would decide what to do. Consequently, when those applications came in from having 10 questions on each page, 100 questions total, that happened throughout the entire southern states. And though Dr. King became the president, and when he came to Montgomery, he had just finished school. Consequently, he didn't have any experience at all. But you know, God works in a mysterious way. And I don't think our leaders, when I say our, I'm talking about human beings, I don't think our leaders just get up and say, "I'm going to be a leader." I think they get close to the Creator. And I think they are guided by that unforeseen mind or little voice. And they can be successful. The first thing Dr. King said was, "What we need to do is to stay off of the bus." And this was around the 5th or 6th of December, when people had out all of their Christmas decorations, Christmas supplies for people. The people stayed off of the bus. The whites wouldn't go on because they feared. The blacks wouldn't go on because that was the plan. And of course, instead of being off of the bus for the rest of the month, they did not ride the bus for the entire year and a great portion of the second year. They put the buses out of business. They put a lot of businesses out of business because if they had spoken out, then everything would have been all right. But the fear kept them from saying, "You are wrong. Let these people be citizens." But no, fear kept them from speaking. And that is one of the handicaps that we have in life. To be afraid when you know that there's something right. Well, Dr. King continued, he began to go about week and speak about love, speak about non-violence. They didn't allow violence of any description. into the organization. We went to Dr. Kenny and asked him, please come and help us. Because it was even worse in Dallas County. Because people could not feel like they were human beings. They were actually set aside. And as far as we were concerned, my husband, me, we could not go to a store and get something unless the price went up. My husband would run off of the road, the car was too low, but he was not hurt. The somebody, Ku Klux Klan, shot in the house right over the head of my son who was studying there. The telephone became a nuisance, beginning 7 o'clock in the evening until 7 o'clock in the morning. Every 5 minutes, get out of town. Your house is going to be bombed. You better not be caught on the street. And we just went on numb, thinking that they wouldn't have the guts to hurt us. But we were wrong. Because my husband, who retired, the pressure was so great that he retired from the federal government and opened an office that was a real estate and insurance agency. And they did all kinds of things. Every time he would do something to help the African Americans, they would come up with something in the paper that would destroy his integrity. But a guy came to the office, and he had a loaded stick. I never seen one before. It had metal on the end. I heard him on the outside saying, where's the going to the office? Somebody said, you see that neon sign right there? His office is below that. But my husband was in the back. And he came to the front. He just come from the dock. He came from the front, from the back. This guy came from the front, came inside the office. And it happened that I was in the small office between the two when this guy met him, took the stick, and made an attempt to hit him. And it just happened that I was there and I caught him. But then, we said, the people on the outside, there were two African Americans. Now mind you, our office was across from the city hall that housed the police department, the fire department, the jail, and of course the city hall. The jail was on the fourth floor. And when he came up, and I said, get out of here, these two African Americans came in, and they said, get out of here, Mr. Tate. They pushed him out. He was cursing some of the worst curses you've ever heard. Give me my stick. And my husband, like Rosa Parks, kept his temper. He said, give him a stick. I threw it out. He took that stick and broke the glass door from the top to the bottom. The two displayed windows were broken. And all of the time, I'm calling the police department across the street. And they would not come until there were no more doors and windows to be broken. They gently led him back across the street to the city hall, and in 5 minutes' time, he was walking down the street. Now, when I stop that, I mean that they didn't do anything to you. But my husband went to the hospital for the last time the next day, and he never came out alive. Now, you speak about being fearful. It's a terrible handicap. And when I think of people being afraid, I think of how their minds are so damn up, like the beaver does when it dams up a creek, canal, or river. That those people are actually afraid. And when my husband died, immediately the sheriff said, all full-blooded white men come to my office, be sworn in and be given amnesty. In the meantime, the young man who Dr. King sent into Selma to help us, called the minister of the bishop, one of the largest churches we have, and said, I would like to have a memorial for Mr. Boynton, who has passed. The minister said, yes, I'll be glad to have it in the church. Then he had to go to the deacon. And the deacon said, oh, no, you don't. You don't have any memorial for that man, because you know that the white folks don't like him. And it shows you how evil goes from one mind to the other. And he said, well, if I can't have it in the church, I'll have it in the street. And they became embarrassed and decided, well, we'll have it in the church. On Friday at 8 o'clock, the people came. But they didn't just walk straight across their earth. Deputized sheriffs by the high sheriff, who said, go out there and don't keep those people in line. So they had to go through this line of deputized sheriffs into the church. Some of them stayed on the outside, some of the sheriffs went in the church. But that was on Friday night. On Monday morning, when these people went to their jobs, they were told, you fired. Now this isn't a private one job. In the factory, in the lumber yard, in the private homes, wherever those people worked, they were told, you fired. And they said, why can't I fire? You attended that meeting for that disappointment last night, Friday night. So you are fired. And you know, I'm going to speak in their minds for the first time. Here I am, and these are all the adults that were fired. Here I am, sitting up at home. My children are out there marching and demonstrating and going to jail in order that I can become a registered voter. And here I'm a slave and unable to go to my church at night. I'm going to get in that house with my children. I'm going to march. I'm going to demonstrate until I become a registered voter. And that was the first time they awoke in order that they could get their human rights and their civil rights. Because there was a was your mind that you could not cross on the other side? Everything was different. For example, when my son became 18 years old, I went to the bookstore to get his books, the 8th grade books. And I gathered the books, carried them to the clerk, and he said, "These are the wrong books." I said, "That came from 8th grade set of books." "Yes, but the colored books are over there." The education was different. Discrimination and education was different. It was, we had to do something. And thank God we did at that time. We're still trying to straighten things up. But when it seems as though we were not going to get what we want, except these people realize that I've got to get in line, I've got to become a regular boy. They did. Now, Dr. King came into Selma on January the 2nd, 1965. These people had decided that whatever they do to their children, that they will take part. If they're going to meet the children, they've got to meet me. And this particular Tuesday, Dr. King was on the federal ground. And because of what a person had to do to make an attempt to register, I decided that I would be there, because it was, you must have property. You first must be 21 years of age. Then you must have property. You must have a home, but with no mortgage on it whatsoever. You must know the Constitution of the United States. You must have two white men, not women, because they were afraid that women had some conscience. But two white men come up and to vouch for and say that you're a good guy and you have everything that they require. Well, you ain't gonna get white men to come up because they felt that they couldn't afford to go against the Ku Klux Klan and the race. So I decided I'd be the one to go. And in the courthouse, when I found that there were so many things that happened there, that they wouldn't let them read, they wouldn't let them write, they wouldn't let them express themselves. And yet the 8th grade didn't know the difference between the Constitution of the United States. And that's what they proposed to recite. And the Lincoln Gettysburg speech, he was very, very eager. And at 12 o'clock, they stopped for dinner. When I came out of the office on the side of the courthouse, I began to walk toward my office. And I was walking parallel to the courthouse. The sheriff had 62 or 65 people that he was going to take to the courthouse, going to take to jail, and the jail was across from my office. And when he saw me, he said, "Get in this line." I said, "I'm going to my office." He said, "I said, get in this line. I said, I'm going to my office." And the third time he said, he ran behind me, grabbed me in the back, propelled me around, and started pushing me. Well, I didn't know what to do. I knew that it was that the organization was a non-violent organization. But I was tempted to hit him. And by the time he got me parallel to these people who were trying to go into the courthouse, they said to me, go to jail, Mr. Moynihan. You want to be there by yourself. We'll be there with you. So he pushed me down more than a half block, threw me in the car, and carted me off to jail. And when I got there, actually, I cried. What have I done for trying to help people? But it wasn't long before I heard the footsteps of these people coming up on the fourth floor. Now, among those people, there were some who were crippled, some who were walking with canes, but it made no difference. They marched them across the city to the courthouse, to the jail. And I heard them talking, and I knew that it was the group that said, you will not be there by yourself. Then the jailer, being near the front in my cell, the jailer got up to open the door. And the keys would not fit. Now, he had been using these keys all the time. And the keys would not fit. Then he said, get me the other set of keys. They brought the other set of keys. And they would not fit the jailer's door. And I heard on the other side of the door, yes, when God closes the door, no man can open it. And then they started singing, come by here, my Lord, come by here, come by here, my Lord, come by here. Come by here, my Lord, come by here. Oh, Lord, come by here. And the jailer said, I have to send for the locksmith. And the locksmith came and said, I can't open this door. I'll have to go back to the office. And I'll have to get acetylene torch and blow this lock open. And here the people are standing. So they took those people back downstairs, brought them up on the elevator, which they should have done at the beginning. And when they passed my cell, they said, we told you you would not be here alone. We told you that we would be here with you. Now that gave me great courage. And I said to myself, you are going to be able to vote. I personally am going to lay myself more on the line and do whatever, accept whatever comes, because my people are going to be able to be citizens like anybody else. Well, we stayed in jail. The first group stayed in jail for about 4 or 5 hours. They were charged with unlawful offense. And mind you now, the sheriff told them exactly where to stand, on the ground of the courthouse. And yet, they were charged with unlawful offense. I stayed in jail until approximately 2 o'clock that morning, when my car was right across the street in front of my office. But when they let me out that late, if I had to walk, it would be exactly what they wanted, to expose me to whatever happened. But I was charged with criminal provocation, whatever that is. Well, now Dr. King and his staff, being on the federal ground, the post office, decided that we are going to the house. And we are going to make plans. Now, when Dr. King came in, that same fearful mentality had frozen the black and the white, because they told the African Americans or the black that Dr. King was a communist, and they didn't know what communism was. They only said that's a fright. And he had nowhere to go, even though on that block, the doctors, the dentists, the professional people of all descriptions were afraid to just say, how do you do, Dr. King? To shake hands with him, to ask him, would you come to my house? So I had to give half of my office, and I turned my house over to him. Now that's where they went to find out what we ought to do next. They did not decide that night. They said, we have to do something. We have to have some type of plan. But what it is, we don't exactly know. Then in the next 3 days, one young man had his mama in a wheelchair, and they had just come from a meeting, a mass meeting, and he saw state troopers are under the supervision of only the governor. And the state trooper made an attempt to hit his mother, who was in a wheelchair, and he stepped between them. And when he stepped between them, the state trooper fired and killed this young man just because of the fact he stepped between this mother who was in the wheelchair to keep her from being molested and keep her from being beaten. Then Dr. King and the group said, what we're going to do is to march to Montgomery. We are going to tell the governor that you are going to have to protect people. And then when that happened, and Dr. King came in the cell, there were people from all over the United States who also came to assist him. In whatever way they possibly could. There were young white people from their universities and their colleges. There were professional white people who left their office. There were Christians. There were people who wanted to do something to straighten up that country. And when they came down, they lived with the people of color. They ate with them. They did whatever they could to lift the burden that we were under. We started off from the church March the 7th 1965. We marched across the bridge, the Alabama River. When we got across the river, there we saw state troopers with gas masks on, state troopers with billy clubs, cattle trucks, on horses. And I looked at them with these gas masks, and I didn't know what would happen. The person who had charge of the state troopers said, "Don't go any farther. Stop, turn around, and go back to your church." And as one of them made an attempt to say something, the head of the state trooper said, "No, you cannot say anything. Charge over them." And they came from the right, they came from the left, they came those few from the front, they started beating people, and I fled. Then I immediately got up and just stood and saw the human blood that was all over this highway. I saw people running, limping. I saw state troopers behind them with a club, beating them. And I think I was frozen. I was so frozen to see human beings treating human beings like that. Horses were used, but the horses had better sense than to step on the human beings, and they would step over. And when everybody was off of the highway, I was on the side then because somebody drug me off of the highway on the side. But I was unconscious because the second lick that they gave me when they said run and I wouldn't run, I fell unconscious to the ground. Then somebody told me, they said, "Is somebody dead? Send the ambulance to pick him up, whoever that is." And the sheriff said, "If anybody's dead over there, let the buzzer be, because I'm not sending anybody to pick up anybody. That way for white or black." They didn't care. So the person who said that said, "Okay, don't send anybody over there, and we are going to burn this town down." And he sent the ambulance to pick me up and carry me to the hospital, and the hospital was filled with people with broken limbs, lacerations of heads and whatnot. When I became conscious of what happened, the first thing I asked is, "And what happened?" And they explained to me. In my heart, I was more determined than ever that this is a war. And unfortunately or fortunately, I am ahead. I am at the front of this battle. Because 35 years we fought to get the right to vote. And then I'm not going to stop now, not as long as I can move. So after about 36 hours, I was released. Dr. King and everyone, we had thousands of people who came. But that night, after we had marched, three young white ministers left my office and decided they were going to get dinner. They went to a black restaurant. And after having eaten, they made a wrong turn when they came out of the restaurant And at the end there was white customers. And these were three white guys, young guys, who approached and came across the street and approached these young men and started beating them. And they beat one guy so bad, and his name was Reverend Weed, James or Jim Weed. He was beaten so badly that they took him, we said, to take him to the office, and immediately they said, well, we've got to take him to the hospital. And they had him here alone, just a few doors down. They got the ambulance, and being white, they carried him to the white hospital. The superintendent came out and said, what are you doing here? You have come into our city to disturb our way of life. We don't need you in your kind, and you can't come into this hospital. So they took him and carried him to the African American hospital, and immediately they knew they didn't have the facilities. They sent him to Birmingham, Alabama, 90 miles away, and he died. That was the supreme price that had been given in all the human beings to be treated as human beings. So, people became very much more concerned. Dr. King, who was supposed to have led that march, called all of his friends who were not in cells to come to cells. And they came. They had a train that came from New York. And when it got to Berkeley, it got to Atlanta. The engineer of the train said, I'm not going any farther because I'm afraid. Whoever it was that was supposed to have assisted me said, well, I'm not going to carry the train any farther. So the train stopped right there in Atlanta. And they had to find some way to get there. Anyway, in the meeting, they decided that they would begin the march as it was before and just march on to Montgomery. But some of the people said, that's what we're here for. We're going to do it on the day after tomorrow. The President of the United States, Lyndon B. Johnson, said, no, you don't. Those people are heathens and they will kill you. You wait until I federalize the truth. So, here Dr. King was between the devil and the blue suit. On one hand, we are here to march and we are going to march. On the other hand, the President said, don't march. But then they decided that we are going to march, so they got together. But we're not going to bring in the law. If they tell us we can't go any farther, we're not going to be any farther. So they marched the same way where we were beaten. And they were also told, turn around and go back to your church. And what they did, they sang a song, knelt, prayed, and turned around and went back to the church. Then later on, the President federalized those same state troops. And successfully, we went on to Montgomery. Of course, you didn't see the guard. He ran. He too was brainwashed. He too feared did not see him. So even though at first they were let us go into the capital, later on they did. And then coming back home, it was late in the evening. And then later that I had been in the car, we were driving on back to Selma, and I noticed on the side there was an ordinary car, and it seems as though somebody just pushed the car over on that side. But what attracted my attention were two state troopers, one on each side. And this is just a two-lane drive, one going east and one going west. I went on down the road and turned around. I got out of the car and approached one of the state troopers and said, "What happened, officer?" He said, "A woman was killed." Now this is coming back from the meeting. So when he said that somebody was killed, I didn't ask him no questions. I got back in the car, turned the radio on, and found out that this lady from Detroit, one of the white women who had been going in and out of the house, the office, picking up people, carrying them what they wanted to do, giving whatever service she possibly could. And coming back, she had one bathroom and a bullet went through the car or through the glass, hit her and killed her immediately. Later on, we found out that there were three men in the car. Two of them were Klan. Ku Klux Klan. One of them was an FBI informant, and he was the one who pulled the trigger. Now that, it is sad to say, but that same attitude, that same mind that we have in Selma, Alabama, it's all over the United States. We had J. Edgar Hoover at that time, who was responsible for the killing of Dr. King, of Malcolm X, of many other people. And we still have to clean up the South and the United States of America. Because if we are our brother's keeper, we cannot look at just saying that I'm here in this little place and I'm going to clean it up. When I think of the Iraq war, and the idea is to go into Iran and other places, that's the same attitude that they had to beat us down. And not only that, it isn't only the South. It's not only the United States of America. It is who's behind it. And who's behind it but big business. Not only big business, but somebody's got to be behind that. And if we think of the linking of the two vice presidents, Great Britain and the United States, and others. But we are in trouble. And this trouble is not the South. It is not only, and I said not the South, but not only the South. It's not only the United States of America. But it's the whole world is in trouble. The house is on fire in the back. And we've got to do something about it. We know that it's wrong, but there are some countries that have sent their children to face the bullets in the world. There are some people who are sending ammunition. There are some countries who are giving over their territory that they may have space for whatever they need. And all of that is fear, because we're so tied up that we are afraid to go against the evil. And then the thing about it is, they will tell you that, oh yes, these folks are against our way of life. And that's the same thing that they say back there when we were young. Our way of life. And so many of us follow. We don't want to have anything to do with you, because they say that you're not going along with the corrupt system. Yes, corrupt system. And here is a man who is trying his best with the organization, Schiller Institute, to let the world know that we are on the same. And we can go the same way as other civilizations have gone. We can be history. The hedge funds are now in the place that they can't help anybody. We notice that their banks, some of them are being propped up by bigger banks. The millions of people who are in their homes and have paid for their mortgages, maybe 15 or 20 years or total, get out. You're going to be evicted because you can't keep the payments on this house. The banks are not going to loan you the money because they are in bad condition. And what are we going to do with the plan and the program that we have, instead of throwing people out of their houses? Let them pay rent. And when they pay, when they're able later on, now, most of these people have 2, 3, 4 jobs, and they can't keep the mortgage up and the other things that they need. The banks are not able to stabilize. But yet, we're saying, let them pay rent. Let the banks be stabilized. But no, the oligarchies don't want that. They want to destroy and become empire. So I say to you, wherever you find anybody who's telling you this world doesn't have to be destroyed, stop. Look at what they're talking about and listen to what they're saying. Because within a few years, you young people are going to take over a corrupt country, a corrupt world. And what you're going to do with it, I don't know, because it is definitely corrupt. So be sure that you are able to understand and to know what is happening. Because you will be sinners, you will be tongues, you will be parliamentarians, you will be all these things within a few years. And to straighten up something that is so wrong, you will have to begin at the very beginning to learn more about what the system is throughout the entire world. Thank you.
Thank you.
you mind if you see the microphone? I'll do that.
Whatever
their constitutional rights are. It is up to them to abide by their constitutional rights.
Okay, thank you so much.
Is that it?
Yeah, I just have one more question. Yeah, I know that many people in Iran, they want to live like you and you say, 40, 50 years ago. You wanted rights, you wanted to live like you want. But they want that now, but the government won't let them. What can we do to help them?
He believes that people in Iran want help from outside the market to get these rights that they that you fought for. What do you believe in that way?
I say if you like what I'm doing and you ask me to please come and help me to be like you, I think I should do it. Definitely, if you ask for it. But I don't think that I have a reason, or I should just say, I'm going to make you Democrat. You don't want to be, but I'm going to push it on you. That is wrong. But if you ask that I help you to make your country like mine, then of course I have the right, I should go on and do it.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. You know, it is awfully hard, as my mother said, to change the leopard's skin. And when I think of how hard people worked back then, those days, to say that this is our way of life and we are not going to change it, they have taught their children how to get what you want. Particularly if you have to push somebody else back. That's one thing we fought for. When we fought along for the right to vote, we also fought for civil rights. Civil rights where everybody, if they're prepared to take a position, they should be given the chance to take that position as well as anybody else. They ought to be able to go to the best school that their children, they'll send their children to the best school. They ought to be able in every walk of life, without being discriminated against, to have the same opportunity and the same chance that anybody else has. Now when it comes down to what we fought for back then those days, those were some of the rights and those were some of the privileges that we had. Today, sorry to say, some of the same things are going on right now in the United States of America. And I'd like to give you one example. in the courtroom of Selma and Alabama, there was an attorney. This attorney is very good. He just died. He has really awakened Selma up. So having some cases in this specific court, he saw a man, a young man, and she went to him and said, "Do you have an attorney?" The young man said, "No, I can't afford it." She said, "Well, would you like for me to be your attorney without charge?" He said, "Oh, thank you. Thank you so much." She went to the judge and said, "Judge, this young man would like for me to be his attorney." And she agreed it was all right, because that's the law. Then the cases went on, they called various cases, and they didn't call this specific case. So later, when it was almost time for court to close, the judge said, "Well, now, we are not going to have any more cases." And she said, "Judge, here's John Joseph's case." And the judge said, "Oh, I'll give you 5 minutes. And she said, "Well, Judge, five minutes will not be enough, because the man has to state his claim and what's wrong and what went on, and I have to try to defend him. I give you 5 minutes, I said." Now that's the attorney she's talking to. And in the pleading of the attorney, she kept on saying, "Now you don't go against me. Get out of my court." And that was the end of the court. So she was saying that, can't we come to some conclusion? And in the rain where the attorney is, there were two people who were security guards. If anything could be done, the security guard was supposed to do it. But instead, there was a man around the audience. He was a police. And believe it or not, his name was Jim Crow. That's really his name, Jim Crow. So Jim Crow, one of the racers, decided when the judge said, "Get out of my class, out of my court," he moved above all the court, went in the ring, past the security guard, grabbed the attorney, shackled the attorney, and began to push her out of the courtroom. Now, if she had to leave, these security guards were supposed to have done it. But Jim Crow decided that I'm gonna show, according to my name, that I'm going to do like all of us should do, and that is destroy African Americans in the courthouse. So they had a case, he appealed the case. And I was there when she appealed. They had another judge. This judge now is supposed to testify what happened. On her side, she had as attorney her son, her brother, her husband, all attorneys, and a white fellow who was retired. He was a retired of training. So the wide attorney got up and said, "This is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. The judge, this is a kangaroo court. None of the rules and regulations have been obeyed. But he just mentioned, which shows you that the very court, and putting this woman, the former judge, on the stand, and she was telling how she did. And it was all illegal according to the constitution of lawyers and judges. And of course, when it was, the case was over, you would expect if anybody were fined, it would be Jim Crow, or it would be the judge. At the end, they fined this African-American attorney $500. Nothing for the rest of us. So you see the importance of continuing to struggle, continuing to get justice, not for me, not just for my children, not for just them, but for you, and you, and you, and you, and the whole world. Because that same attitude may not be, because may not be, because of color, but it will be of finance, because now so many of us are slaves to the credit card. We are slaves to try to make it where we have to bed to sleep in at night. So we have to fight for justice for everybody, and that we can look back there at 1965 and know that that's just the guideline that we've got to keep on fighting. You know, there's a time for everything. And I think Martin Luther, in his day, acted accordingly. Now, he changed, he actually changed the attitude of a whole lot of people in the world. And many of them are unborn. He changed them from hate to love, from violence to nonviolence. But you know, when we think of how we have no say, we have no control over death. And Dr. King died, but it was his time. It's shocking the way he did. But God has a way of doing things that we don't understand. He was leaving these garbage collectors who were getting less than $3 an hour. And he was trying to show that these people are needed and they need to be given the respect and the dignity of anybody else. But what happened is the evil people decided that we are going to destroy him in any way, we're going to destroy his way of life. So with J. Edgar Hoover, who was one person paid by federal money, decided that we were going to break this up. And they paid people to start fighting in the line, in the march. And those people started fighting. You look at that now, and look what's happening today. The same thing is happening in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in other places. The same identical thing. Paying people to fight against each other in Africa and other places. But God decided, when they tried to destroy him, he said, enough is enough. I'll call you to a greater reward. And one shot, just one, killed off the king. And the governor said, if Dr. King had stayed in his place, now his place, that he would not have been killed. In the meantime, he got out of his place and made an attempt to run as a candidate for the President of the United States. And he was shot. Dr. King died immediately. George Wallace lived for 30-some-odd years, unable to eat by himself, unable to go to the bathroom, being in a chair, being swiveled up to almost nothing. Then I said to myself, it spoke about Dr. King in his place. He was in his place. Were you, George Wallace, in your place? That was a time. Now, if Dr. King were living now, he would perhaps continue to fight non-violently and giving love instead of hate. Because those two things, they never get old. It never becomes obsolete to say, we don't need love anymore. So if he were there, he would continue the same thing. But the system is, the world is, that as great men leave this world, there are young people, they are doing it because of that. The world is like that, leaving room for the younger ones to come out, and the younger ones to prepare themselves to take Dr. King's place, to take your greatest leader's place, to take FDR's place, and even to take Lyndon LaRouche's place, to take my place, because we are not going to live forever. So prepare yourself. If Dr. King were living, he would say the same thing.
So what do you think about the war on drugs?
after a question, after the war on terrorists, and Dick Cheney, I'd like to speak on that. What do you think about
on Dick Cheney and here?
And on the war on terrorists. You know, Afghanistan and Iraq, just go on that.
You're putting me on the spot. You know, personally, I think war is evil. And somebody is the aggressor in any war. There's something that a person, in fact, a country has that another country wants. It's just in the cases that I have seen, it's like an adult who takes the candy away from the baby and eats it himself. And that is what is going on when it comes down to war. Almost every war I know is because some country wants what the other country has. And yet the countries are so indelibly entwined among each other that there's no reason why they should feel like they do when the system is that you can, I will sell you what I got. Now, when you want to get something that is wrong, put an evil person in place. We have a president. And we are not pleased. He has not been elected president. He has been just placed there. He has been selected. There is never a place in history where the Supreme Court decides who's going to be president. And in this last election, you had what is places, particularly people who were working class, people who were the poorer class, the people who were, they were people who believed in justice. What happened in many of those cases is that they paid the machine. In other words, they went into one of these communities where they expected 25,000 votes to go through. They would pay maybe 1,000 and all of the other votes that are cast doesn't wait. They had places where people were turned back and said that the place is closed, the voting polls are closed. They had people where they had roadblocks. And this is what happened again while George Bush was president. George Bush is not prepared, literally. He is not prepared. But he looked at the vice president, Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney feeds him the stuff that they didn't and Great Britain give. So it's a vicious circle. Well, the objective is actually to destroy the United States of America. That's the whole objective. And I have told you in a number of speeches that the time, if they continue to destroy the country and the condition in which we are, because when it comes down to war, we have drained United States of America
financial. We go to visit other countries and ask them to loan us, whether we owe them because they loan us the money or the time or whatever it might be. We are now 63, and more than that now, 63 trillion dollars in debt. 63 trillion dollars. And how are we going to pay it? It's no way. But what's going to happen, I believe, unless we straighten up and get out of this war, I see where we are going to cut up, be cut up like you do a cake or pie, and be divided among all these other countries that we owe because we can't pay. We're going to be worse than Germany was. So these people who are doing it don't care. But what about the generations that are living and the generations hereafter? It is a matter of not caring. That's why we are going down the drain. There is good among a part of the United States. We don't take a part. We don't claim what George Bush and Cheney and others are doing, because they are not going the way of the American Constitution, as is for us to abide by.
There are ideas, there are plans how to solve this. We can solve the economic financial crisis.
crisis, we can develop nations, but we have to steer so-called money and these financial values in order to contribute to building the economy, the real economy, building infrastructure, water systems all over the world, building a modern transport railway system, building power plants, and all kinds of things which human beings need. Because we have a system which is based on financial speculation. People want to make money from in the stock market rather than using money to build nations. And in that context, what was discussed in the conference where Amelia was, that this plan for what is called a Eurasian language to build bridges, real bridges, to connect nations and continents. And that way we can actually get nations to work together and establish what was a former quote that called peace through development. You can achieve peace not by just simply signing a paper, making a political agreement, but you have to build relations among nations with economic cooperation and economic development. And that's why the idea which Amelia is there in her time the face of the evil was clear. There had been crisis. And people were fighting for economic and social justice. But today it is the same, in spite of the fact that there are different colors, different types of people who are doing the same thing, and different people of different colors and different nations are fighting for justice. But the question is that the idea of human rights cannot be separated from economic justice, that people have the right to develop, people have the right to have their children going to school, having good health care, having good jobs, having enough food, having electricity. So these two things in this modern time cannot be separated. And I think this is one thing which maybe Amelia is thinking about, that we have the problem not on the racism, we do have racism today, but we have injustice in terms of the economic side of what's happening in Africa. Africa is being denied the right to develop because they have an unjust international economic system. And my question to Amelia is, how do we connect this idea of fighting racism and fighting social injustice with the idea of getting economic development and economic cooperation among nations?
I remember there was a song once that said, love and marriage will gather like a horse and carriage. But you can't have one without the other. Economy is a part of life. It is a part of every person, because when you think of everybody must have shelter, they must have clothing, and they must have food. And the beautiful thing about it is that people have learned to barter, to exchange, to buy, so consequently the world is of such that we are able to enjoy what the other part of the world has. So I guess in the short term is that you can't have one without the other.
Well, maybe I would like to ask one or two more questions, and I think I want you to ask. Great, young man.
Can I hear the report of the beginning, please? I have a dream.
We don't have it. No, we don't have it. But would you like us to talk about it?
Yeah.
Not me, you.
What?
You explain. The question was
about Marvel's
Oh, he just asked me, yeah. No, he asked. Listen to me. If you thought about it, I said, you can't listen to it because you don't have it. But you think so, what you think
Martin Luther King wrote so many speeches, and all of them were very, very good. I think one of the speeches that we just seem to know more about is "I Have a Dream." It was beautiful. But what impressed me more was the last speech that he made. I told you that he was leading God's workers, the most humble type of employment a person could get. After those people started fighting, he went on, led to the end where the march stopped, and went directly to his room at the Lorraine Hotel. That evening, because he had been speaking every night and then every evening somewhere. That evening, they had a big mass meeting. And he was tired. He just didn't feel like one. Then the vice president came in, and he suggested that the vice president take his place. And his associates around him said, "No, Dr. King, they don't want him, they want you." And then they kept on kicking it around, and finally he said, "Well, I don't feel like going, but I will." And when he went, the church full of people, a part of the speech was not what happened, but it was of himself. And to look at him, you wonder, how did he happen to be transformed? His eyes became as light. And it seemed as though there was something like a halo around his head when he uttered those words, these words. "I have been to the mountaintop. I have seen the glory of God. I will not be with you, no doubt, when you get there. But I have gotten and I have seen." And then he told him to march on and continue until you get justice with my own hands of water. So that, to me, was the most impressive thing. Because some way, I believe, they had seen that he had seen that there would be a change. And no doubt, something was going to happen. And that same night, after he had gone to bed, the next morning somebody called him and he stepped out on the veranda or the porch, and a shot was fired, one shot. And he died right there without even knowing what happened. So I feel that the Creator said, "Well done, well done, thy good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things, and now I'll make you faithful over many. If you read the Bible, you know, I don't know exactly, but that was the essence of it. I will make you ruler over many. Come up a little higher. That's the whole thing. Come up a little higher. I'm tired of your being abused down there. I'm tired of people slandering you. You have taken all of it away. You have taken enough. So come up a little higher. That's the way I feel about it. And I stopped being sad because he died. But I look at, after you have done the best you can, and even the world does not understand, but God knows just how much you've been there. And that, I think, is why God called you at the peace of trying to help the most humble people in the world. I want to say in the closing that this is the most beautiful audience that I have been in to speak directly. I'm very proud. And I feel that instead of my giving you something, which I hope I have, that you have given to me more than I will ever be able to give to you. Because when I see these young people and see that they are people who feel that they have something to give, something to offer, when they came up here, I could see within the minds of those people some of the greatest hope we will have in this section. So I said, thank you. Thank you very much. Just about every place that we have attacked, it was something in it that the people had that we wanted. It was the oil, and then in the case of Iraq. Then not only was it in the oil, it's a matter of using this as a springboard to go from there to Iran, and maybe Turkey, and maybe Pakistan, and who knows where, to become an empire throughout the world, to possess and to dictate to the world what we want. Another British empire. And that's the reason I believe that they have attacked.
and everything?
I mean, I saw someone over there had that question. Okay, I'll just ask one last question. What would you ask the young people here to do now?
I guess I would ask them to do what maybe the minister would ask if he had a group of young people. To go to the world and preach the gospel and remember all other nations. What I would ask them to do. Number one, I hope that I have said something that believes in your mind that you know that you can use. And that is, politically, that you fight to keep your constitution in use. That you will live according to your constitution, that you would realize that you are not in this world just to pick up this to have faith, but you have an objective in this world. That is why you are living, and what you do is to prepare yourself for whatever you are going to do in life. And realize that this is why you're here. This is why you gained your education. This is why you're learning. And this is why you have an aim in life. Let me say this to those who, when you finish school, you may not go any farther, but you take yourself a vocation. Life is not smooth. Life is not a gold shell. Life, as you grow, it changes. Where you are now, Lord, you have help from your parents. But life is also, like if you say, this automobile that I am in, I am going to the end of my destination. You may not know what it is. But on your way, you have curves, you have soft shoulders, you have detours, you have roadblocks, you have some little crossroads to turn around, turn. So these are roadblocks that are in your life as you go along. But then, you don't just ignore it. You find a way to get around. So that's the way it relates with life. And that is the way that you will be able to obtain whatever you want to in life. So always use patience. And above all, use faith. Because in the event that you have the faith that you're going to reach your goal in life, in the event that you have your faith, you have to do away with fear. And you have to have trust in the Almighty that you will reach that goal in life. Because whatever we do, we cannot do it by ourselves. And as I said before, about God making man
That's your soul. That's your conscience. That's your mind that will tell you, instead of going in this direction, instead of going in the straight direction, because my mind tells me that I need to go the straight way. So follow your mind. Follow your mind. Because that's the reason why we now. So I may not say all of you again, but I bid you Godspeed, and in your life, I hope, with faith, and with courage, and with working toward your aim in life, may you attain whatever you wish in life. Work at it. You will get it. But above all, don't fall in the slot of fear. Because if you're afraid to do the right thing, you have handicapped yourself. So go forward and do the thing that you know is right with the guidance of your heart and your mind. You will reach the greatest height that you wish to attain.
Eller på allihopa att ta tillsammans, eller?
Ja. hon är där igen.
Ja.
Well, I had a few years in the most life.
I just want to say it's an honor to meet you. Very nice to see you.
Du en gång förut. Ja, för långt fram.
Vi har två kan. Vi ska göra det stort. Lot bigger. We have 28 stuff all together.
Yeah, but
I think it was a smaller audience. From 16 to 18. Thank you very much. And we appreciate you made the effort to come here.
Thank you. Whether you got a job or not, whether you know how to do anything or not, you're going to see that they're trying to talk about doing like that. And now, since he's dead, they're trying to destroy this kind of feeling. Because we want to be people, you know, to be know what we want to do. We want to try to expose and be able to do the leg.
Måste ni gå vidare eller? Ja, förlåt. Vi får stanna mitt hit till nästa. Hej, hej.
Det rör.
Ja, ha det bra. Nu har vi en timme till nästa event.
Okej, är det två där?
Klockan är ett.
Jag skulle vilja ha två där. Jag skulle vilja ha två där. Jaha, men vi borde äta någonting va?
Vi har bara... Ja, just
det. Man kan inte äta på mat. Jag tycker men ska vi gå och äta någonting? Vill du ha mat?
Ja, det vet jag inte. Det är åtta stycken som står där och lyssnar på henne nu.
Jag skulle vilja säga att det bästa är att sätta fjärna man också. Kan vi bara bjuda och säga till folk att de kan följa med på det?
Ja, vi tänkte åka dit till Fjällgatan, till Ersta. Och vi har ju inte plats i bilen.
Nej, men vi kan väl äta här och sen åka dit, om vi bara ska äta. Men det är också lite sen.
Ja, alltså som jag ser det nu, vi får ju bara ta något.
Idag hade vi en timme, då hade vi äta, hoppa och vi kommer en halvtimme sen.
Ja, men jag tänker att det tog också
att
de här människorna...
Men jag måste nog börja dra ändå. Okej, men vänta, vi ses länge fram. Det var jättebra att du kommer här.
Se till att få... Du måste få namn från de där åtta.
Det ska jag. Okej, ha det bra.
Men aldrig slut.
Jo.
Vänta, jag kan inte...
Vi har bara en timme kvar till nästa.
Men har du bara
en timme kvar till nästa event?
Det finns inte några vanliga kontakter också.
Jo, de är där.
Nej, det är pappret här. Det är två papper.
Men jag vill ha bonus av mig.
Ja, jag såg inget annat.
Nej, vi har två. Det är två här.
Nej, det är ingen farligt. Det är ingen skillnad. Den är ganska svår att få tag på. Det kommer att kosta oss något.
Ja, precis.
Nej, jag tror
att
två kan gå.
Nej,
på
engelska.
Ja, det står. Det
är
väl din. Okej, tack så länge.
Det är bra.
Ja. Hej, vi hörs.
Okay. Ja, jag tog bara sätta lite när jag såg. Va? Det var trots honom.
Ja, vilken härlig dag.
Ja, fantastiskt.
Ja, väldigt fin.
Ja. Men hon gjorde väl inte.
Ja, visst. Ja. Sen är det ju, alltså, om man bara ska vara lite efterklok för vår egen del så är det nog en årskurs 3-grej, en sån här.
Aha.
Det krävs lite förmåga att kunna koncentrera sig både engelskan och att kunna koncentrera sig under en längre stund.
Ja, och sätta in det i ett sammanhang.
Lyssna på den och se den här gången igen, för kanske vi kan lägga den på vår hemsida.
De måste kunna sätta in det i ett sammanhang.
Precis, det också. Man har kunnat både se det historiskt och samtidigt. Man ska kunna göra sig med fortfarande inte mycket inriktad själv.
Så du menar att de här var gick i första?
Både alla första och årskurs 1 på det.
Det var det. Ja, okej. Okay,
jag undrar hade nog pushat så att det bara blir 3. Jag skulle bara nog fått ut lite mer.
Det är miljö 10.
Ja,
det här är information. Om det är fred genom ekonomisk utveckling. Det så man kan lämna kontakten.
Nu fick jag två.
Ja.
Jaha. Tackar dig också.
Ja.
Mycket trevligt och det var ju bra att vi fick möjligheten.
Vi hade något att diskutera.
Visst, men det är som det här. Det här är ju... Ja, visst. I det här sammanhanget får vi jobba vidare.
Man kan ju anknyta till att hon berättade om